Now stay tuned for To Your Health on WPVC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here's your host, MC Blair.
Hey, good morning, good morning. Good Saturday morning to you. I am MC Blair, and I'm here at our WPVC studios. I've got lots of stuff to talk about today. Absolutely. And we've got some great interviews. I have a new segment called Saturday at the City Market, and I will be either at the City Market or I may go out to the Afton Farmers Market from time to time and talk to vendors and just sort of bring you the latest and the greatest in real food production. And of course, we know why that's so important for good health. And it begins with the soil. As a matter of fact, I have a headline that says, "The secret to growing more food with fewer chemicals? Squirmy soil." Of course, over the past century, we've abused our soils, and it's true. And recent studies suggest that they can be revived to support a sustainable food system. Our soils are in trouble. Totally, totally in trouble. Over the past century, we've abused them with plowing, tilling, and too much fertilizer. And it's not just dirt. Most people, "Oh, it's just dirt." Well, the problem is that when you plow a field or over-till it, they increase erosion by 10 to 100 times the natural rates. And over just the last several decades, we have lost about half of the topsoil. And you need topsoil to grow food. Unbelievable, right? And that took over thousands of years to build up, and we've lost half of it in just a few decades. And my beef farmer, John Whiteside, he's a Wolf Creek farm. He says that it's all about the soil. And, of course, we know that's true. It is all about the soil. Healthy soil equals healthy plants equals healthy animals who graze and fertilize. No chemicals needed, and quite frankly, wanted. But until recently, big food has stripped the topsoil and virtually raped our land. Now listen to that. Just listen to that. It's a total crime, in my opinion. Big ag and big food just needs to be shut down. We need to go to local, communal markets, models. And it works, the co-op, not communal, but, well, community agriculture is different than communes, obviously. And we're not talking about that. We're not talking about communes. We're talking about a co-op. So one farm does, you know, produces eggs and chickens, and one farm produces cattle, and one farm produces all the different produce, and you have a co-op of family farms, and together they feed the entire community. And this model will work nationwide, regardless of what big food wants you to believe. And of course, we know that big food and big meat contribute most of the global warming greenhouse gases, and that's a fact. I don't care what anybody says. If they say differently, they're incorrect. Now, all this food, attention to the topsoil has started to get to the mainstream, which is good, and it's through the customers demanding it. General Mills, believe it or not, they're working with the Nature Conservatory and the Soil Health Institute to encourage farming practices that begin to rebuild soils. So that's a good thing. Wow. I was really thrilled when I found that out. And, of course, the first step to improving soil health is to stop the bleeding, obviously. It's just like here. If you get cut, you know, you can say, "Well, you need to change your diet," and yeah, that's great, but you need to stop the bleeding first, obviously, right? And so instead of leaving fields barren in between crops, which, of course, leads to erosion, farmers are increasingly planting cover crops, such as ryegrass, oats, and alfalfa. They're also replacing intensive tilling with no-till practices, and that prevents the breakdown of the soil structure. Now, let me tell you just a little bit about that. We have fungal soil structures underneath the soil. The fungus grows, and they form these intricate networks. And when we till, it just destroys it, tears it right up, and then, of course, releases a lot of carbon into the air as opposed to sequestering it, because carbon sequestration is one of the prime results of maintaining good soil. It keeps the carbon in the soil. It doesn't release it. And, of course, you know, everything's made of carbon, so you need it in the soil. So in no-till or extremely low-till, you kind of scratch the surface, and then you can plant your seeds and all that, and it seems to work really nice. Now, I will also say that cover crops are great, and you know, they've been doing that in Europe and, you know, since the beginning of agriculture. It's the way to go. However, if you have a complete farm, which includes animals, you've got the animals grazing, like the cows will go in and they'll graze the grass down to a decent level, and then you move them to another pasture every day. And then the egg layers come in behind the cows and they scratch the you know, the cow patties, and they eat the fly larva protein pills. And they do that, and so it's a constant cycle. And therefore, you don't need the cover crops, because the whole farm is a living organism. Now, soil organic matter contains over 50% carbon. There you go. So they contain more carbon than plants and atmosphere combined. So when you lose that carbon-rich organic matter from the soil, it releases CO2, which, of course, is a greenhouse gas, and that accelerates climate change. But by regenerating our soils, we can sequester more carbon underground and slow climate warming. Now, in addition to protecting soil, cover crops take carbon out of the atmosphere as they grow. Big surprise. And they funnel it into the soil. But unlike cash crops that are harvested and removed from the soil, cover crops are left to decompose and contribute to the soil formation. Now, increasing the supply of plant carbon in this way, it's an important first step in rebuilding the soil. But they have some new research out there, and it says that might actually be insufficient. They think of the soil as rejuvenated from plant matter decaying. Recently, however, technological advances have transformed our understanding of soil formation. Now, we've had guests here that have known this for years and have always treated their farms, as I said earlier, as a living organism, a complete system. And now, of course, there's strong evidence that the most persistent forms of soil carbon are formed primarily from dead microbial bodies. So remember I said at the top, from squirmy soil? Well, those are little microbes, and they're squirming around in there. And when they die, they decompose, and that is a huge form of carbon. And also, that is what really does the most to rejuvenating soil. Now, they say that plants are the original soil, but the microbes control its fate by using it as food. They used the decayed plant material as food, and it ensures that the least will remain in the soil. Now, Joel Salatin of Polyface Farm, I spent, about 3 hours with Joel on his farm. We walked all around, and he explained the whole thing. He has fields that do not freeze in the wintertime. Now, I'm going to say that again. His fields don't freeze, even if it's been 20 degrees or below 20 degrees for weeks at a time, which doesn't happen often, but it does happen. His fields are still spongy and not frozen, because the microbial action is so strong, and it generates heat, and it keeps the temperature above 32. Now, his soil system, because of this, since 1960 they've been doing this, and because of this, his soil system acts like a wick to the water below the ground, the aquifers and the groundwater, and as a result, the farm is drought-proof. Now, when we were there, we were in the middle of a drought that had been going on for a long time, 15 years, officially. Fields on both sides were brown, dead, looking bad. His fields, long, tall grass up to our knees, The ground was spongy. It was so wet with water. And he hasn't fertilized or watered his fields ever, ever. It's because he's doing it the right way. As I said, he's got the grasses. He brings his cattle in there. They graze the grass down to a decent level, and then they get moved. It brings in the egg layers. They scratch the cow patties, eat the larva, and of course, then the cow patty material is absorbed right into the soil. Lots of microbes there, and actually, the next day, you can't even tell cows were in that field. Now, I don't know if you've been around cow fields before, but when they lay their patties and they sit there in the sun and nothing happens to them. And then eventually they go away if you get a rain or whatever, and they get dispersed. And there's these big either brown or yellow spots where the cow patties were. Well, that doesn't exist at Joel Salatin's farm or any farm that does a free union grass farm the same way. The egg layers go behind the cattle and take care of it. And it's a complete system. Yeah, pretty cool, right? And so we are going to... We have a great interview with Diane Burns. She is a certified horticulturist, yes, at Pippin Hill Farm. And that's down there by, down 29 at the corner of 29 and Plank Road. And they have great vineyards down there. They're also a great wedding venue. And we are going to talk to her, or I talked to her. I'm going to play the interview. Right, we'll start it. Right about, let's see. There it goes.
This is MC Blair. I am in the kitchen garden of Pippin Hill Vineyards and Tasting Room. Wonderful, wonderful property. And I am with Diane Burns. She is the certified horticulturist at Pippin Hill. And we are in the kitchen garden, as I said before. And so tell me, Diane, what exactly is this kitchen garden?
Well, we've expanded our kitchen gardens here at Pippin Hill, and we've doubled the size this spring. And the kitchen gardens are here to provide fresh produce for the kitchen that's going to be prepared and on the menu and served to our customers on a daily basis. So we're standing in our expanded garden right here. It's been great. I have 12 raised beds that are 6 feet by 16 feet. It's given me a great opportunity to grow bigger stuff, bigger vegetables. So last season, I kind of felt like I was just supplementing the kitchen with produce. And this year, I feel like I can really supply them 100% of certain items that they're highlighting on the menu.
So. Well, I believe that. It's quite extensive, quite frankly. I've seen some that are a couple of raised beds, and they're able to provide some herbs and a few tomatoes and that sort of thing, but this is definitely quite extensive.
Yeah, it's really rewarding to me to be able to show the fruits of my labor and share it with the kitchen and have it being prepared and appreciated on a daily basis.
So, Diane, I was on the Pippin Hill website, and I noticed a term there that makes sense to me, but I had heretofore not heard it. It's agrotourism. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Agrotourism is a relatively new concept here in the United States, but it's been around for decades over in Europe, specifically in France and Italy and England. I first heard of the term when I was traveling in Italy about 10 years ago and had the chance to stay in an agroturismo. And that all came about back in the 50s and 60s when farms were kind of failing a little bit. They weren't as profitable as they once were, and a lot of farms were being abandoned. So the government actually stepped in and enacted a law in the mid-1980s to encourage agroturismos, small local farm stays, to set up and open up to the public and provide an opportunity for people to come in, see what the country lifestyle is like, give them a place to stay, and some of them even actually offer opportunities to work on the farm.
That's great.
Yeah.
So how has agrotourism fared in the United States so far?
Well, it's gaining popularity basically for the same reasons. Increase of population, land is skyrocketing, and small farmers have had to look for other ways to bring in revenue, to diversify the revenue. And agrotourism, I almost said agroturismo, agrotourism is a great way to do that. And what that basically is opening up your farm or ranch to the local population, the general public, for them to come in and have a recreational experience, an entertaining experience, or an educational option as well. Here at Pippin Hill, we kind of feel like we fit into that sector. We're a farm, for one. We grow grapes here for our wines. Secondly, we offer the opportunity for family and friends to come here to taste our wines in an incredibly beautiful setting and bond over food and wine together. And the educational aspect is that we do encourage people to come in and walk around our gardens, see what we're growing, how we're growing it. And I feel like there's been a real disconnect over the last few decades between people and the food source. They're not really knowing where their food is coming from. And by coming here and seeing what we're growing, what I am picking that day, and what is being prepared in the kitchen that day to be served on the table is really something special and very unique.
Yes, I see that. I was with Jamie at Bel Air Farm.
Yeah, I know Jamie.
And he's a great guy. And he's doing similar to that, you know, encouraging the community to come by. And he's got Pick Your Own program and some other programs that does the same thing. So I think that the more and more farms get into this, the better the community will be informed and the better health.
Yep, absolutely. And agriculture is the number one industry in the state of Virginia, with tourism following behind at number three. So it's really no surprise that agrotourism is gaining popularity. It's gaining traction in the sector.
Now, you mentioned Virginia Tech had done some studies on that. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. They came out with a fiscal impact study not too long ago in 2015, and it showed that agrotourism generated economic activity or stimulated economic activity in Virginia by $2.2 billion. And in state and local tax revenue alone, it generated something over $134 million.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and it's significant. And it's not only money that's being generated, it's providing job opportunities for people in rural communities.
Even better.
Yeah.
And we're back. Yes, indeed. Okay, we're going to continue with that wonderful interview with Diane Burns from Pippin Hill. So we're picking Sun Gold cherry tomatoes, and I just tasted one. And I remember as a boy, I would go out in the tomato garden, and I always took a salt shaker with me when we would take the tomatoes. Well, since I found out that tomatoes have really high sodium content, and to put salt on, it's like salt on salt. Folks, I just tried one of these. Oh, my goodness.
It's probably the sweetest cherry tomato you'll ever taste in your life.
Oh, man. I could eat a bowl full tomorrow. I wouldn't need any, keep the salt. I don't need it.
Sun Gold tomatoes have the highest Brix content out of any other tomato. And Brix, B-R-I-X, is the sugar content in fruits and vegetables.
Very important in wine as well.
Yes, exactly, in our grapes. So they're very sweet. And what's also kind of unique about the Sun Gold tomatoes is that you will never find these in a grocery store. Sun Gold tomatoes have very thin skin. And for commercial growers to pick, package, and deliver and take a chance of breaking skins, they're not going to do it.
Another good reason to buy local.
Exactly. Buy local or local farmers.
Because you'll see things. If somebody grows these, they could take them to the farmer's market as well.
Exactly. And that's a good segue into another aspect of agrotourism here in Virginia, of how we support it or how we're a part of it, is that we host our local farmers here every Friday. I should say every Friday we host one farmer, and we call the event Featured Farmer Friday.
Featured Farmer Friday.
Yeah.
A great idea.
It is a wonderful idea.
So what exactly is Featured Farmer Friday?
So every Friday we feature one local farmer come out here, set up on our veranda, and sell their local produce. We provide them not only the space to do that, but we provided them a great marketing opportunity. A lot of our farmers that come out here are small startups, so we get them wonderful exposure. Our marketing team here does a great job with social media, putting their name out there and talking the event up. So it's a win-win situation for them and for us, showing that we support our local farmers. And at the end of the day, any of the Old Sun produce, you know, we try to buy back as much as we can to use in our kitchen here.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, it is.
Keeping it local, folks.
Yeah. Win-win situation.
Yeah, win-win is good.
Yeah.
So who you got next Friday?
Next Friday on the 11th, we have the Swain Elderberry Farm coming out here.
I have not heard of them.
Michelle Swain, they have their own startup, and they grow nothing but elderberries. And they started it for medicinal purposes, but it's also just a wonderful tasting berry. The elderberry is a native shrub. It's a great food source for our local birds, but it does produce a delicious tasting berry. I'm sure most people have probably heard of elderberry wine. wine.
Exactly.
But you can also make a syrup out of it, and it's great on vanilla ice cream and on pancakes, and it's just delicious fresh, too.
Probably loaded with antioxidants, I bet.
Oh, tons of antioxidants, anti-inflammatories. It has great medicinal value.
Wow, that's great. Mm-hmm. So who's that, the Swain?
Yeah, Michelle Swain.
Okay.
They're located in Afton.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. We're on our way to the kitchen, and we decided to take the path through our meadow garden here. And this meadow garden was established by my predecessor, Amy Lewis, who's a fabulous horticulturist and gardener. She created it about 5 years ago, and it was created as a way to encourage native bees and butterflies and birds back to our area. I wish you could see this. All these bees and butterflies that we're looking at, a tiger swallowtail butterfly on our native Monarda bee balm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The native is called Monarda fistulosa. And what's really significant about planting natives is that with our increase of population here and developments coming in, we're losing our natural spaces, our wild spaces. Thus, we're losing a lot of habitat for our native species. By planting natives, we are really rebuilding our ecosystem here. The swallowtail butterfly that's on the Monarda right now, mm-hmm, starts from a caterpillar. A caterpillar's survival is dependent upon a diet of about 99% native plant material. Baby birds, fledglings, their diet consists of a very high-protein insect diet, and their diet is 96% caterpillars. So you see, you take one link out of this change of our ecosystem and things start to break apart.
Yes.
So it was a great endeavor by Amy to plant this fabulous meadow garden that's filled with hundreds of species of native plants and native grasses. And in turn, I'm trying to do the same. We've had a few landscaping projects going around the facility, and whenever possible, I'm trying to plant native plants just for that, to recreate, reestablish these very important food webs for our native species, and to provide a real structure, a real living structure for them to live in.
Man, we are now headed to the wonderful Pippin Hill Kitchen.
We're here with Brett in the kitchen.
With Brett in the kitchen. Hey, Brett.
Brett's our lead line cook.
Oh, okay. Hey, that's a good position. I've done that.
It's all right. Not bad. The Sungold tomatoes are on two different places in our menu. They're used in our heirloom tomato salad, which has burrata and lemon oil and fresh basil, also from the garden. Mm-hmm. They also go on top of a snapper dish, which they're mixed with cucumbers from our garden, and also some parsley beans, which are also harvested from our garden.
Yeah, good.
So, yeah, we're using just about everything from the garden in every way we can.
That's awesome.
So,
yeah. Thanks.
You're welcome.
We are now on the veranda, and it's starting to fill up already. I got some folks out here. It's gorgeous, gorgeous view.
Yeah. So this is just a great spot to hang out with family and friends over a glass of wine. We, in the kitchen, devises small little bites, food plates to share. So it truly is just an excellent opportunity to bond and have some quality time.
Well, one of the things I noticed, Diane, was that, you know, when we were out in the garden, and even though it's only about 85 or so like that, it was starting to feel kind of hot.
Yes.
You know? And now I come on the veranda. It's out of the sun, obviously.
Yeah.
But then they have these fans blowing, and it's
cool cross
actually
breeze.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice, definitely. The view is spectacular. Do we want to talk about what brought me into gardening or why I love gardening?
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what brought you into gardening?
Well, other than just a love for being outdoors and a true appreciation for nature and what it has to offer, I really love having that feeling of being connected to the land. I love the fact that my day-to-day job is so tied in with the cycles of the season. Here it is, the beginning of August, the days are getting shorter, and I'm thinking and planning out my fall plantings and production, what I'm going to do. Last week, as a matter of fact, I got my Brussels sprouts in the garden for fall production. So it's a wonderful sense and feeling of really being related to the land.
I see that. And then I suppose once you're attached to the land, being attached to the community is probably just a automatic step, a logical step.
Yeah, it is. It's very rewarding. Part of my job here at Pippin Hill is to take people on garden walks and talk about what we're doing here, what we're growing, and what we're trying to do. I tell you, one of the really things that I love about my job here at Pippin Hill is that I get a lot of satisfaction of seeing the fruits of my labor being used in the kitchen and prepared and being appreciated on a daily basis.
That's got to be rewarding.
There's not too many jobs that really offer that, and I truly love it here. It's a great place to work.
Awesome. Thank you, Diane. Really enjoyed this.
Thank you, MC. Thank you very much for coming. Please come on back.
My pleasure. Yes, that was such a great interview. I just love talking to folks out there and finding out basically what makes them tick, right? So I am going to attempt to play, and I say attempt to play. I'm going to have to use my recorder directly. I went to the city market, and I got some cool interviews with some of the local vendors. So we're going to see how this works. I wasn't able to get it onto an MP3, unfortunately. So we're going to try it out and see what happens here. Hopefully, you'll hear it. It's good.
This is MC, and I am here at the city market in Charlottesville, down Water Street, and we are going to talk with various vendors, and we're calling this segment Saturday at the Market. So the first up is Broadhead Farm. I've actually been out to Broadhead Farm, and they're doing a great thing out there. All blah, 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 blah. Okay. Edit. So we're coming up to Broadhead Mountain Farm with Wally Parks, and here you go. Hey, Wally, how's it going today?
Great, Mike. How are you doing?
We're doing well. Good. You're doing well. How's business so far?
Pretty good, yeah.
Good.
Pretty
good. Yeah. Now, I'm a sweet potato eater, and as you know, I understand you had a record year.
We had a really good harvest this year, Mike. Nothing we can take credit for. We're just grateful for the abundance of sweet potatoes. Yeah.
And that's good in a year. This is MC, and I am here at the city market in Charlottesville, down the street.
Sorry, guys, it sort of reset. I told you we have to get through here. Oh, boy. Well, bear with us. Hear it again.
They're doing a great thing out there. All blah, 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 blah.
Blah, blah, blah. That's my edit. I was supposed to edit it. See, I couldn't do it.
So we're talking with... So we're coming up to Broadhead Mountain Farm with Wally Parks. And here you go. Hey, Wally, how's it going today?
Great, Mike. How are you doing?
We're doing well. How's business so far?
Pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, good. Now, I'm a sweet potato eater, and as you know, understand you had a record year.
We had a really good harvest this year, Mike. Nothing we can take credit for. We're just grateful for the abundance of sweet potatoes. Yeah.
And that's good in a year where there's been a lot of record not so good.
Correct.
Like
rub it in, but yeah. That's right.
And I noticed the okra's looking particularly nice, and I think you had a little story about that.
Well, a couple weeks ago, you know, we had some close to record cold temperatures. It was going down in the 40s, and the okra just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as it got hot and humid again this week, the okra just took off, yellow flowers and pods everywhere. But I've never seen something like okra in the garden that totally stops and then comes back. That's a little bit unusual.
I notice your peppers, especially your red bell peppers, are looking awfully good.
September is pepper month, Micah. That's kind of apropos for the time of year. But yeah, they ripen beautiful red, and they'll hold on the plant really long this time of year too, because of the cooler nights and all. So September is ultimate pepper month.
Well, that's one of the things that I like about shopping at City Market. There are some vendors that will purchase, you know, product, unfortunately, but when you know you're at the right place, when things that are supposed to be in season are offered for sale.
And that's, you know, we have it in season and not out of season.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's healthier.
Yep.
You mentioned Wally Whites. Now, what are those?
Years ago, probably 10 years ago, I had a rogue sweet potato. When I was digging, I was like, this doesn't look like the rest of them. And we cooked it, and it was white fleshed on the inside. So I didn't eat any more. I saved them and grew slips off of them the next year, and we've been growing them ever since. But because I don't know what they are, my name is Wally, we call them Wally Whites.
And you just mentioned the purples coming up. Was that
another sweet potato? Now, those were given to me by a girl that works in this market, Rachel over there at the Profanities.
Okay.
But she gave me those potatoes, and she doesn't know what they are either. But she grows slips off of them, and I grew slips off of them.
Oh, my.
R-E-I-L-L-Y.
We're talking to Michael Riley, who has an app in which he rates farms and various other things. His app is called Foodwaze, W-A-Z-E. And how did you get started?
Well, my journey really began through the angle of health. I really had not had any background in farming or food or anything like that. My previous background was in broadcasting. I became more focused on my health just through some family issues. We all have family issues somewhere. And I was kind of going through some health issues myself. And so I just focused more on eating healthier food and cleaner food. Organic food, pasture-raised meat, all those things that I think are so important to maintaining good health. And I was seeing really positive results, so I was just becoming more and more passionate about it. And as I did, I realized it was really hard to actually find those places. Whenever I traveled around, going out to eat, I couldn't really, identify exactly what type of food I was really eating. And I know there are some pretty good resources out there, particularly focused on farming, but I found that, really the go-to app on the phone was Yelp. And I found it to be completely useless in terms of identifying types of food, kind of food. And so I started Foodwaze.
That's amazing. Yeah. So,
no cost. There's no cost. The app is free. When we started it, we did have the ambition to create a revenue stream from it. And we're continuing to really sort of explore those options. Right now, we consider ourselves a for-profit social enterprise. We're contemplating, whether we may just go nonprofit, because really what we've sort of evolved into is a real advocate for, for a better food system. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do, is identify farms, everything from farms to restaurants to coffee shops. I'm looking around the market here and looking at so much great food. We're trying to find those all those businesses and food enterprises that are really pushing forward the food system to be more healthful, more sustainable. We like to use the word regenerative now. That's a big term tying into climate change, because people don't realize how much food is entangled in so many issues, from climate to economics to social issues. And that's really what we want to do, is we want to be an advocate for change in the food system.
That's awesome, because I've always said, and one thing I took from the biodynamic farming model was, we're all part of the whole. And one of the things that we have been missing is somebody like yourself that can be a conduit. For healthy food, clean health, clean water, clean air, clean food. That's what we need to survive.
And I mean, even down at the market, the market's great. There are wonderful people here, some really cool vendors. But I think it's important for farms like where we're standing right here that people know just what they're doing compared to some of the other vendors that are down here. Again, not taking away from anybody else, but I think to really change our food system, which I think is so critical right now with all the issues that are going on, we need to we need to have some sort of a way for people to know and identify a place like, you know, Broad Fork Mountain Farm. Why are they so amazing? Because, you know, they're not out there advertising themselves and, you know, tooting their horn. I've been to their farm and I've seen, you know, the way they farm and what their practices are, as with so many farms around here. And I'm hoping that we can sort of be that arbiter for people to say, like, okay, you know, I need to make better choices and I need to make sure my food is clean and doesn't have pesticides and chemicals, and that the practices on the farm are, you know, good for the land, good for the earth, and good for the environment. And that's what we want to be able to do. And same thing with restaurants. And,
absolutely.
I mean, you know, you go up and down this mall and there's just like unbelievable number of restaurants, and a lot of them are good, they taste good, you can go have a good meal, you can have fun, but we're really looking, and a lot of them do source from, you know, local purveyors.
True.
And it's great.
Like Hamilton's.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but we're looking again for restaurants to really push the envelope.
And Maya.
Yeah,
actually.
Exactly.
Yes, yes.
Maya, yep. And really, really, again, sort of go beyond just like farm to table or, you know, locally sourced. Local ingredients when we can. I hear that one a lot.
Yeah, it's true.
We just really want to, you know, again, we want to encourage restaurants to push beyond that and say, okay, it's not so much about, like, you know, having a cool blackboard with local farms. It's really about improving the health of our world, the people that eat at the restaurant, you know, the environment, whether it's the types of takeout materials that you're, you know, that you're using, you know, compostable items and other environmental practices that we're focused on. But, you know, I think it's, I guess my hope is that we can have a world where people, where restaurateurs can evolve into, instead of just, you know, they need to make money. It's a business. Everybody in farms need to make money. And so we can't look past that. That's part of sustainability. But at the same time, we hope that food can evolve to where health, overall health, human health, global environmental, planetary health will not be sacrificed against profits.
Yeah, we're going to take a little break here. You are listening to Your Health right here at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Okay, and we are back. We have Scott Brown on the telephone. And can you hear me, Scott?
I can indeed, Mike. Good morning. Happy second day of autumn, and before you ask me anything, I thought I'd hijack you quickly with a question for this time of year. It's pumpkin everything now, of course. Pumpkin lattes, pumpkin air freshener, pumpkin underwear, pumpkin gasoline, you know. So I'd like to know your thoughts because they're sort of similar looking, they're similar tasting, but are you more of a fan of pumpkin pie or sweet potato pie?
Pumpkin pie for me.
Okay, I'm the sweet potato pie guy. I think it tastes a little better, and I also think it's healthier for you.
And it is.
The rest of your show.
You are so right. It is healthier. I should have said that. I missed the calling there, because sweet potatoes are in the cruciferous family, and they are just loaded with minerals and vitamins that are so helpful to your immune system.
So where are the sweet potato lattes? I haven't heard of that.
Sweet potato latte, really? Well, we'll have to talk to our local, maybe Shenandoah Joe Coffee House, and
sure,
talk to them about that sweet potato latte. That's a good one. So, hey, Scott, you told me, you know, some things about yourself, and it's why I brought you on.
They were all lies. They were all lies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Disregard that, folks. This is not fake news. Scott has a malady. We're going to talk about it. And the reason I brought you on, Scott, was our show's To Your Health. And it was, and I like to bring people on that are concerned with their health and have actually done something, are proactive to increase or improve their health. And of course, you were forced into it. And could you tell us a little bit about the story? Because I find it, you know, most interesting.
Well, yeah, I'd be happy to. Back about 7-plus years ago, 2009, I was working at the voiceover studio that I was working at. And I'd had a certain amount of little aches and pains in my body. I'd even gone out to Walmart, of all places, and bought a little aluminum cane to help me get around. But, you know, at that age, I don't know. You know, lifetime after lifetime, you have no idea what you're supposed to feel like at any given age.
Right.
So, you know, at that age, I'm thinking, okay, maybe I'm getting older. Maybe these are just the aches and pains that come along with turning into an old dude. And so, I was in between the voiceover gigs I was recording, and one of my buddies who was in another studio doing another voiceover had left his young child in a car seat kind of a thing strapped in the green room. So I'm, you know, I love kids. I've got plenty of my own, I think I know who most of them are. I'm clowning around for the kid and doing a lot of old vaudeville or music hall type goofy stuff.
Yeah, the physical comedy
that I had seen on Ed Sullivan growing up.
Oh,
you
right.
know, and one of them was I don't know if you remember the old gag of standing in a door frame so that one of your arms is out of view, and you use that arm that's out of view to pretend like it's another person.
Absolutely.
Coming in from that side, tapping you on the shoulder, interacting with you. So I did that, and I had my other arm as another person grab my nose and pull me off camera, so to speak. Unfortunately, I did this little leg whip kind of thing to affect what would look like I was really being pulled by another
right,
entity.
Right, right, right.
And I guess when I did that, I shattered my upper femur and didn't know it. And when I brought my leg down to stand upright on the other side of the door frame, I ended up on my back with my leg bent behind me and not at the knee.
Mm.
And I thought, well, this is not at all right. Something's wrong here. I'd never had a broken bone in my body. So when they came and took me to the emergency room at the local or closest hospital, they looked at me under the microscope and they said, well, you know what, you don't just have this one bone problem. You pretty much are a mess from head to toe. You've got what's called multiple myeloma. It's a condition that weakens your whole skeletal structure. And that is where all these aches and pains had been coming from over a period of time that I'd been trying to cure with a little Bayer back and body, relief on occasion when it got too bad. But they took me to a closer by hospital that had a specialty in this bone kind of malady. And once I'd been through the ringer with tests and this and that, they basically let me and my stepfather, who was a surgeon, a nutritionalist, and a healer in this area here in Virginia Beach,
Dr. Brewer.
Norfolk area. Dr. Brewer, right? He had worked a lot with the Casey Foundation, so he our whole family was aware of alternative health options. And they basically told me and he related to most of the family that I was stage 4 multiple myeloma and had about a year to live.
Mm.
Now, this was back in 2009. Because of my growing up in a family where we had these alternative health options and ideas and philosophies, I wasn't immediately ready to jump on board with believing what the doctor said. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if negative emotions can make you unhealthy and positive emotions can make you healthy, I'm going to treat myself as my own private science fair project. And basically, I decided, when they dosed me with radiation or chemo or whatever they chose that they thought were the only things they could work with, rather than be fearful that a chemical was being put into my body and that I was, you know, allowing myself to be an experiment for something bad, instead I'd be a good cheerleader and just say, come on in, do your best, and while I was being dosed with something else, I would dose it myself with a bunch of love and see where that led me. And here we are, like I said, almost 8 years later. I've been kicking the can down the street. I've gone into remission. I've gone back out of it again and tried some other options. Most recently, another option that was not at all available to me back in 2009 or 2010 was available, and I decided to try that. And I'm back in remission again from that. and getting a little once a month maintenance treatment. But basically, I've had a chance to see a couple of new grandchildren show up, walk one daughter down the aisle, do a bunch of things I wouldn't have been able to do if that 1 year that they gave me originally was the actual diagnosis.
No,
and
that
course,
is so awesome.
As you can
awesome.
Imagine, I've changed up a lot of my physical regimen, but also a lot of my health regimen and what I eat. And I think that might have brought, you know, us to the point where you decided to give me a call.
Well, exactly. And I just want to let everybody know they're listening to Your Health right here at 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, WPVC. And we're talking with Scott Brown, who has bone cancer, basically, was given a year to live. Nine years ago. So
that's right.
And
I really stretched that 1 year into dynamite eight.
I was going to say, you know, those years are long, aren't they? So I guess you must have it broken down into things to live for. You know, right? I mean, is this what's kind of keeping you going? Is it?
I think there's all sorts of ways to approach this. One is to certainly try to fill your body up with a lot of love, because I think that sets up a vibratory system in your health your body that creates health and creates harmony.
And then couple that with diet.
You know, if you cannot be negative about stuff, that would be my first, is try to approach stuff with a lot of open possibilities of good and fun in mm-hmm. what you do. And then another thing, of course, is certainly trying to eat as healthy as you possibly can. But another one is, just kick the can down the road a little bit at a time. And I have things mm-hmm. I look forward to. I'll put a date out there 2 or 3 months ahead of where I am. That way I'm sort of still living in the here and now, but at the same time, I'm also visualizing and seeing myself enjoying that little option in the future. Mm-hmm. And I think that's helpful in putting me in that scenario once I get 3 or 4 months down the line and there I am again.
So didn't the doctors...
Things like grandkids coming along and I'm waiting to look forward to walking a daughter. I've got my youngest, I'm densely populated with daughters, and my youngest is currently doing grad work in Asheville, North Carolina for becoming an acupuncturist and working with Asian herbal medicine, and I was on the phone with her the other day, and she said, you know, Dad, I don't know, they haven't found a cure for what you've got yet, and the possibility is there that you could leave us at any time, but she said, I really hope, you know, I'm going to see you at my graduation, and if I ever get married, have you there, and so, you know, that's a very future sort of a thing to look forward to down the pike, because she'll be there at least for 4 years doing graduate work. But you know, I mean, that's one of the things that I look forward to, and I try to see myself in that picture so that my visualization helps create the reality.
Absolutely. So like you had mentioned something that the doctor had said, if in fact you do go past that year, that you won't be able to stand up again, and yet you're doing stand up.
Well, that was the other thing they told me. They told me that I would probably be lucky if I ever got out of my wheelchair. And at the time they told me this, I wasn't even yet in a wheelchair. I was still trying to figure out how to navigate as my leg was healing. And I've got a metal pole from my knee up to my hip on the right-hand side. But basically, I figured out how to get in that wheelchair. And eventually I thought, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. And I want to see if I can find a way to not just do some of the exercising I'm doing in the exercise room, but also take that out in public. And so I started to find ways to use my wheelchair more like a walker and stand up and get behind it and hold on to it and walk with the aid of the wheels. And the longer I did that, the stronger my legs got. And then moved in with my daughter so she could be helpful to me. And I found myself getting around the house without the wheelchair, basically. And I'd go out in public, and of course, I'd still take my, own personal park bench with me. But more and more, I found myself, you know, relying on my own ability and holding on to something that was maybe over to the side. And then the next thing that came along was we all had to get out of the house we were in, and we weren't going to be able to move collectively to another house together. So I found a new place to live next to Old Dominion University here in Norfolk. Mm-hmm. And the only room available to rent was one at the top of the stairs. And I had not tried a stair at all. I mean, I was fearful, too, in a way. But, of course, fear is the opposite of love. So, you know, that was not a good thing for me to stay in that headspace. And I decided, okay, you know, I don't have many other options. I've got to have a place by a certain time. So I'm going to take this room, and I'll just slowly navigate these stairs. And by doing that, it really created a better musculature to my legs. And eventually I found myself getting around with just the use of a cane out in public, and I still take that with me as a bit of a cheat in case something goes awry, but I've gone out and started doing stand-up comedy again, which I did for years professionally, and I also have actually gotten into joining some people half or a third my age doing improv comedy. They know that they're not going to ask me to do any of the really physical games, but at the same time, I still hold my own with a bunch of folks doing improv comedy, and that's caused me and a former member of a comedy group I had through the 80s that toured around the country to talk about getting an old dude's improv group together, and so we're in the midst of maybe creating something like that. I think we'll call ourselves the Improvisionaries, or the Imps for short.
Imps.
You know, that could be fun, too. But that's all part of creating a valuable life for myself for however long I've still got to go, is still having fun, still being creative, and still trying to not just sit around and mope and do nothing.
That is so awesome. You know, I'm just inspired when I hear your story, because, of course, I've, you know, known you for more years than I care or can remember. So, you know, and
well, how long has it been since we met?
Oh, my gosh.
About
it was the 70s. Yeah, something
like that.
Yeah. It was amazing. And I remember that was the time you were a vegetarian. You said you'd get sick if you went by and smelled the
well,
the beef smoke from the Burger King.
I actually quit eating beef and pork back in 1971 after reading a book by a guy named Hans Selye called Food is Your Best Medicine.
Right.
And it wasn't really in protest of people killing animals, because I knew that meat was still going to be on the grocery store shelves anyway. But I thought, you know, if these things are really the most contributory to colon cancer, I can do without them.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I shifted to just eating fish for a long time, and then I added poultry back in. My mother, you know, during one Thanksgiving, she used to always make me a little extra something that was a fish or something so I didn't have to eat the turkey, but that turkey smelled so good that one Thanksgiving. I just succumbed, and so and it didn't get me sick. So I still eat poultry now. But
right.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't had any beef or pork since 1971.
That's something else. Well, I've had a good time talking to you. I'm going to do my 2-minute drill that I call it. You're welcome to stay on and listen to that.
Oh, sure. And I give you more than a year to live too. I think you're not very healthy in the mind. You're a sick man. But I love you, and I'm going to send you a lot of vibes, and we'll see you around. You'll have this radio show for a while. I'm
pretty
sure of that.
Well, you know, for 40 years, folks, from the late 50s to the late 90s was when the U.S. government started to, with the best of intentions, encourage the factory farm model through farm subsidies, tax breaks to participating farms. Now, today we're faced with the logical result of another case of changing the natural order of things. Big ag, big meat, corporate control of our food system is a recipe for disaster, because the corporate model dictates profit over everything, as opposed to a local small farmer who practices taking care of the soil, the water use, and general health of the produce and meat products. And it will result in better health of the people, not only physically, but also a community with a general commitment to work together. This, of course, will take time. And we here at To Your Health are committed to helping the many true food citizens like Michael from Edible Landscaping, like so many of our guests, to get the world out to the, or get the word out to the general public, who we hope care about improving their health and life in general. The move towards the local food began in the 60s with the organic movement and the concerns about health and environmental risks associated with synthetic fertilizers and pesticides were not only the reasons they chose to grow foods organically, and it was all about the commitment to treating the whole farm as a living organism, not just a profit center. Treating the workers well, with a living wage, and working with the community at large. Big farming corporations have gotten into the organic market, but that's not the point. To be truly healthful, food needs to be raised locally by a farmer who believes the before-mentioned principles, those of soil health, carbon sequestration, and being part of the whole. So let's do this, listeners. Let's research how to become involved. Look up the Food Justice Network and decide which of the many participating organizations, there's 16 of them, that you can donate to or volunteer for, especially the Urban Agricultural Collective of Charlottesville, UACC, and you will be rewarded in ways yet unimagined. I want to thank all my guests, and especially Scott, for calling in, and I want to thank all of you who download our show. I hope something you hear sparks the desire to know more. And remember, participating in community activities, treating your bodies with care, and eating real foods are keys to your health.
You've been listening to Your Health with your host, MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.